Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
McGill. But once again, I am not a GM this time
around. Oh, yeah, you're the guide. I forgot.
I am the guide.
Forgot we are still doing that. It is the 5th of September, 2023, and we are recording... which episode is this now? The 162nd episode, I believe. Yep. That seems to be right by my count.
It's like we passed by 150 and everything got confused.
Everything got a little blurry, for sure. It's less distinct at this point. It's just like, it's all past 150, so who's even counting?
The amorphous mass that is Compare and Campaign.
Yeah, it's there. Our cup runneth over. I don't know. Do you got anything in the role-playing game world to talk about, McGill?
Gosh, in the RPG world, Tom, not really. Been slowly pondering ideas for running a game of Wicked Ones, which we've discussed. I think I'll do a short Wicked Ones campaign over the winter. It'd be pretty fun.
Oh, I'm excited for that.
But besides that, I've really only been running my usual Forgotten Realms campaigns, and those have been going pretty well. It's funny because I started off running these two campaigns concurrently and running them exactly the same, but there were a couple of points in, like, I guess what you'd call Act 2, where the different parties made different choices and have wound up doing the same adventures but facing against different types of enemies. Sort of like I set up both campaigns to have this bottleneck where there are different invading and attacking enemy forces, and one group went one way and the other group went the other way. So one group is like facing off against mimics, and then the other group is facing off against Modrons.
Ah, classic.
Turned out pretty interestingly, but running pretty much, you know, like similar structured adventures based on the same modules, but just sort of find and replace the enemies and reskin, you know, a few details here and there.
I mean, this is really getting down to the heart of, comparing campaign is all about, is like the campaigns that you've run and how did they go and whatnot, and mm-hmm. where did your characters make different decisions and whatnot. I'm curious, you know, I gave you a track that I've always wanted to use for a Modron invasion. Did you use that track?
Which
That's
track
the
was that?
Algorithm remix of the Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger.
Oh yeah, I did. There was an adventure that I ran as part of the Modron centric version of this campaign, and let me just pull up because I have the details on it here. It's funny. It's a module that is clearly just based off of Terminator, where, again, I took a module that someone else created and I reskinned it to be about Modrons instead of Terminators. But it's an adventure by this guy, DM Roy. You can find it at dmroy.com for free. It's called Rise of the Forged. And the idea is that it's a factory that's creating Terminator robots, basically. And I made it a factory that's creating Modrons, a new type of Modron unit that's going to be used for this big attack on Waterdeep. And it was when the players were working their way through that factory is when I used that track.
Is this...
I thought it was a factory
is
track.
This, are we witnessing in your game the Great Modron March?
Yeah, we are. God.
That's some serious stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. I've still got misgivings about my current ongoing role-playing game project, my whole Iceland thing. You know,
And I remain puzzled, Tom. I remain puzzled by your misgivings, because it sure sounds like it's going pretty well and your players are enjoying it. And as I said last time, you know, everything you detailed that you weren't happy about, all I could see in it was the potential to do some fun and interesting things. So, I don't know. Have you had further thoughts on why you're feeling that lack of inspiration?
Well, there's definitely a thing of, like, so the thing is, I am working on there's the game that I'm running that is set in Iceland, and it is a modern day game with supernatural elements. And then there is the, like, setting book that I am doing for modern Iceland alongside it. But the trick is that they are not of the same, like the one that I'm running for my friends that has supernatural elements, but the setting book I want to, like, not have supernatural elements. There's something very specific about the setting book where it's like there is a need that I am trying to meet that is not being met, where, like, there are games, I mean, there is a book available on DriveThruRPG of Mythic Iceland, so, like, you could do Fantasy Iceland that's covered. And to an extent, I just feel like there's already a lot of, like, Monster of the Week sort of content online and things like that, but I don't feel that there is a lot of, like, sort of Tom Clancy style modern, like, paramilitary, products. There are some games that are made to this end, but, like, I don't know, but maybe it's a foolish project. Maybe I've came up with that idea, but I sort of launched into it without having the whole thing, because I think I think it may have been something you said in a previous episode, or maybe we're just talking previously, but it's this thing of, like, I've got all the ideas floating around there, but, like, I just haven't found the story. Like, I don't know where, I don't know what direction I'm going with it, and that is frustrating for me.
But that's one of those spots where, you know, when I look at the setting that you have created, and you sent me the info on the world, and I'm thinking about this, like, you know, it's like paramilitary versus supernatural, right? Or paramilitary versus creatures. Have I got that right? Paranormal?
I mean, in the
Iceland XCOM?
Not in the world book that I wrote, but in the
right.
But in the game that I've been running.
Yeah, exactly. I just, my mind instantly goes to all these different sort of story arcs that we've seen elsewhere. I know I recommended that movie Spectral to you. And as I've said before, I don't think the movie's amazing, but it's like, it's a military unit fighting ghosts in a war-torn city. It's kind of a neat premise. And I also think of that Dark Pictures anthology game, the one where it's like the military folks in the pyramid, was it? Or the ruins? I'm trying to remember.
It's, I got, mean, like, you don't want to spoil that one, let me tell you.
Right. But the good one, the one that I liked out of the Dark Pictures games, that one has, like, military versus, you know, monsters kind of a thing going on. I don't know, man. I'm kind of perplexed as to what's holding you up. It's just sort of like none of these ideas are really grabbing you, huh?
I mean, there's definitely one thing I would say regarding, like, what came to mind when you mentioned the thing of the Dark Pictures anthology. That is very much like a military team that's sort of, like, cut off and in crisis, right? And
yeah,
that is not an element I really have in this game going. Like, they have, like, a base that they've, like, been beefing up and all this stuff, and, like, they have pretty good coverage of, like, or like a pretty good ability to, like, deploy and redeploy across the country of Iceland. Which, you know, it sort of takes away that layer of crisis where it's like, oh, we've lost contact with our higher ups or something, which, like, you know, I could do something like that. I just don't know that it's like,
yeah, you know exactly what I'm about to say, which is what I always like to do is, like, take away their toys, take away their stuff, cut them off for a bit, see what happens.
Yeah.
Raise the stakes.
I don't know. Again, it's like it's tricky in my head the way that I have this problem with boots on the ground, but I don't have it with teeth, because like teeth has just come together so fantastically for me, and I'm like, I'm still running teeth and I'm not running into these problems with teeth. So it's not like it's a me problem, you know? Like it's definitely this specific game project, because if it was just me, then I'd be having the same problem in teeth, right?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, well, it does sound like something about what you've got set up for boots on the ground just isn't sparking that inspiration in you.
It's not scratching that itch.
It's not scratching that itch. But your players seem pretty happy with it.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know, man. Like I have the utmost faith that you'll figure out what to do with it. I'm just trying to think of possible suggestions in case there are any other DMs listening who are struggling with a similar thing.
Yeah.
Just figure out what would inspire you and make it that.
I mean, they got their next mission coming up. They found out that there's a weapon shipment that got shipwrecked along the southern coast in the area of Thick Vibire. And they got to go and ideally take down potentially vampire terrorists, criminals that are attempting to get to that shipment through the sort of emergency relief efforts that are going on in the area. That's like, you know, that's a premise for a mission, at least. I got that much.
Yeah. When I think of Iceland, I think of certain creatures like giants or trolls. All I can think is, you know, maybe there's a cult faction that's trying to awaken an ancient Icelandic giant. You ever see that movie Troll Hunter?
Yeah, I was thinking of that, but
there's that enormous troll right at the very end. It's like the size of a skyscraper. Maybe, you know, maybe there's an evil paramilitary faction that wants to have these giants on their side as weapons, basically.
I feel like the cult angle,
like one from Game of Thrones.
I feel like the cult angle, like, it definitely, the idea that I had that I was most satisfied with from that is the idea of like a firearms worshipping cult. I like the idea
of
all these gun nuts rolling up in Iceland and starting shrines and stuff and chanting while they clean their rifles and etc.
Yeah, we've talked about the gun cult idea before. I really like that. Of course, I really think that the thing to do with the gun cult, I can't get out of my head now ever since you suggested it in relation to Far Cry. Love the idea of doing a campaign where the villains are a gun cult, but the heroes are getting like tricked out with all this weaponry to fight them. And then the final reveal is that the heroes are actually the prophesied chosen ones who the gun cult are worshiping.
I was even going to do that in this game that I've been running in Boots on the Ground. We had a guy that was like a crazy revolver expert, and I had the cult send him
Revolver Ocelot on the team.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was the inspiration. It was kind of like, you know, when Boots on the Ground started, it was a thing of like everybody kind of took their own point of inspiration. So like for one person, it was Ghost Recon, but for someone else, it was Metal Gear Solid. And then for someone else, it was G.I. Joe. And
okay,
the trick is,
I mean, Metal Gear is definitely, I hadn't thought about it, but I think that one is the point of reference that I would probably run with.
Well,
most.
Unfortunately, the player has had to drop out of the game, and it sucks because I had this whole setup where like he uses these like antique revolvers, and then someone sent him bullets that were like perfectly matched to his weird obscure firearms, and he was like, "Huh, who could this be from?" And it was going to be from the firearms cult, that's like a secret admirer, but yeah, now it just had to go through without him.
Is he out of the game for good?
Yeah, it seems that way.
Oh, well, NPC his character and then have the the players discover that he's the chosen one of the gun cult, but then they have to like get him back or seek him out or something. He's disappeared. Where's he gone?
Maybe. I could still maybe do that. I don't know. All right.
The search for Shooting McBoom. Whatever his name is.
His name was Kimura, which may Kimura. Or may not.
The search for Kimura.
May or may not be the, like, he's like Montenegrin. And so I think he's like, it's like the Montenegrin word for a chamber, like a firing chamber. I don't even know if we like, I don't even know if we confirmed that it was like the same word for a firing chamber of a revolver. So it may just be that his name means room, but you know, sometimes that'll happen. I picked up on it. So when we left off with me over in Coyote's Aegis, I'd been running this Operation Failing Moon based on the occupation of Sith Morcaine.
Yeah.
Yeah? You, that all rings a bell?
Yeah, of course. Sith Morcaine, we've talked about several times in the past. I piped up last episode going like, oh, Sith Morcaine, of course, the Underdark Outpost. And we've talked about it before as well when some of my players in the Forgotten Realms... I can't even remember if we talked about it on the... We talked about it on the podcast in relation to other modules. And then off the podcast, I think, because some of my players in the aforementioned Forgotten Realms campaign were going there.
Well, also, I just misspoke because actually it wasn't Sith Morcaine. It wasn't the occupation of Sith Morcaine. We did that ages ago. This one... is DDEX 315 Sith Morcaine Unbound. This is the one
that's
where
right.
You're ending the occupation. And so for this one, I've got them working on the incoming attack on Ashgrain Outpost, which I've repeatedly referred to as the slave-driven industrial breadbasket of Agaloc. Imagine, you know, you've got this huge haunted wintry forest of Agaloc, but then right in the middle of it, they dig out a huge old pit mine and there's just big old smoked stacks and it's all misery and big gouts of flame and all that. Right in the middle of the forest. So that's where we're going. But along the way, we got to gather up all the help we can get. So, we had just talked to some stone giants, broken them out of their madness, with the help of, well, with some guidance from a poor little goblin named Deg, and having won the allegiance of the stone giants by freeing them from their madness caused by the dark crystal that they had been given.
That's right.
So...
gazing into the dark crystal.
Yeah, Gent gathers up some Underdark crystal shards while she's there, and the giants give simple directions to the nearest river, though they admit that they don't venture beyond the factory often. And so the party heads out to try and find that river. They travel through the forest for another hour before finally discovering the waterfall that Issa indicated to them during using telepathy. The vegetation around the waterfall is thick, offering them multiple angles from which to approach while remaining in cover. They ascend to the top of the waterfall at a short distance, then draw nearer to scope out the immediate area. Through the thick bushes and tall ferns, they can see three drones, all drow by the look of it. Two of them are male, while the other is female. Along the side of the waterfall, the female drone appears to be stacking stones into a cairn and whispering to herself. One of the other drones appears injured, burned by the look of it. He seems to be attempting to wash or cool his burns with the nearby water. The last one is looking over the waterfall, surveying the length of the river below. And Gent walks up towards them with their hands up, and doesn't use stealth. They just openly make noise and say hello. The female drone scowls, but both she and the one with the burns are silent as the third one strides towards Gent confidently. Khan Aishir, yourself? He gestures to himself and then Gent, implying a trade of names. And Gent says, Gent, believe we may be able to assist you with your injuries if you will allow. And Connor steps forward. He gestures to the injured drone. This is Cog. He just took out 2 Azers and 2 Hellhounds, so forgive him if he's not in a sociable mood. But also take that accomplishment into consideration. Khandaishir gives a small, thin smile. Cog is clearly reluctant. Khan squints at Connor. I mean, you don't look like any kinds of slavers I've seen, nor escaped slaves for that matter. So who are you? And are there more of you out there? He looks to see if anyone else emerges from the brush. Hex slithers out. We are the advanced forces of the Draelic army. We are here to end the tyranny and slavery in this land. Hex Aquila Calavera, by the way. And he offers his hand. Khan smiles and he says, that's what I like to hear. He gives Cog an encouraging nod, then goes to shake Hex's hand. Cog raises an eyebrow at Connor, and Connor will jiggle his holy symbol and says, Paler's Light is great for what burns, you know? Better than aloe. And Khan gives a chuckle. Bit of a tough sell for our kind, you should know. Cog rolls his eyes and shrugs, pulling some of his clothing back to reveal burns so Connor can examine and treat them. Connor gives them a heal. That was a fun little joke. Do you catch that about Paylor's Light and how it's good for what ails you? But then he's talking to a drow. They got sunlight sensitivity.
Yeah.
Bing bong.
Awkward.
The female continues to observe them and carefully in silence. Cog hesitates before bowing slightly to Connor and saying, my thanks, priest. Khan smiles. All right, you've helped us. Now tell me, how can we help you? You and your cause, that is. And Hex says, well, we're seeking allies in the fight. If you're up to it, we'd be able to offer arms and supplies. If not, we'd ask that you clear the area. Get safe, you know? Well, we certainly know the area, Khan replies confidently. The humans built plenty of entrances and passages down into the Underdark, but that's our territory. So it might not surprise you to know that we have our own ways in and out where the humans believe that they have things locked down. Khan nods to the female drone who approaches but remains silent. Rhea here can serve as a guide. She bows her head, but you get the distinct sense that she is silently judging them all, perhaps sizing them up. Rhea sighs. You intend to slay Lord Dengor? Hex says, not sure who that is, but we already assassinated Lord Dio and our army marches on the mantle. Dengor is Lord of Ashgrain Outpost. He's a fire giant, and he has fallen to the madness of Grast. Ashgrain was always little more than a massive slave pit, but Dengor's endless thirst for industry now fuels every forge and powers every machine. Raw materials are processed and worked day and night, with no apparent target or limit beyond the scope of Dengor's own notions of grandeur. It has become a place devoted to all-consuming labor, Cog explains. Oh shit, I was doing Rhea's voice, and then it was actually Cog explaining that one. Whatever. What exactly do you know of Gratst? Connor asked. And they say, only what Lord Dengor proclaimed to us while we were worked to death. He claims he is Lord of the Darkness and that Gratst sent him forth from the Underdark to rule in his name. Well, sounds like we have one more demon to drive out to me. And from what I understand, the demon lord merely provides justification and or encouragement for his bottomless greed and cruelty. Rhea squints at the group, then walks over to the cairn she was just constructing. Reaching down behind it, she picks something up and approaches the group with it. She holds out a javelin, laid flat across both her hands in offering. Its twisted and jagged spikes suggest that it is drow in design and origin. If you would strike out at Dengor, I would have you use this in your efforts. It belonged to my love, who fell to the slaver patrols today. Let it be a thorn in their side, to remind them of the terrible mistake they made this day. And, so, there's a little, discussion here. So, there's, Hex asked Jen if she wants the javelin, because her pistol seemed a little underwhelming. She says, I could grab a javelin. And, it's a +2 vicious javelin. We add to Jen's sheet, but then I say, well, looking at a javelin, Jen would be proficient in its use. You don't think, you can't actually use your dexterity over strength for the javelin attack. And she's like, oh, dang, then I guess I'll give it to Connor. And so Connor grabs it. But let me tell you, Connor is eventually going to become quite fond of this javelin. I feel like he, like, kind of sleeps on it for a while. But eventually, see, I live in a timeline and a future wherein I've heard Connor say, I grab my javelin and get to javelin many, many times. Javelin is, like, Connor's melee move these days.
This is like the start of the James Gunn Suicide Squad.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, the javelin. I forgot about that. No, Connor, he's got a shotgun, but he doesn't have much of a, like, dedicated melee option, which is where the javelin comes in. He gets to javelin.
Grabble in the javelin.
So I say, though, I'm like, so your attack bonus with it would be only +8, and the damage would only be 1d6 +2 pierce with bonus on crits. While we're here, though, Jen has that oath bow that speaks Elven to her, though she doesn't understand it. We may want to add that to Jen's sheet. And Jen's like, when did I get that guy? A bow and arrow? I'm like, yeah, I'm actually realizing this is just something that got passed from Methley when she left because she'd never been able to use it. And Jen's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. I'm like, so the way this works is when you knock an arrow, it whispers something you don't understand in Elvish. And Chantel says, like, when I worked for the Greek dry cleaner in Guelph, yeesh. And I say, then you say swift death to my enemies, at which point the target of your attack is marked for 7 days or until it dies. And Jet's like, wow. I'm like, when marked in this way, you get advantage to attack the target with the bow. You ignore partial cover. You suffer no disadvantage from long range, and you do an extra 3d6 damage. However, while your sworn enemy marked with this weapon lives, you have disadvantage on all other weapon attacks. The bow is named Shadow Song, and you can only use it because your rogue feature that lets you use magic items... you shouldn't be able to. Hence, a badass elven bow whose language you don't speak. I read a bit of the lore behind this. Each of the elven oath bows are possessed of mythical power in ancient legends. Shadow Song is hewn from a supple yet length of yew and features curious green metal tendrils snaking through its length. It glows dimly in the presence of humans. And the base attack line for the bow is Shadow Song on Gent is +10 to hit. 1d8 +4 pierce, but then it has that marking feature. And then Gent says, well, with my sneak attack, it's insane. And I'm like, yeah. And I like the idea you've literally been avoiding it because of the language barrier. But now you just passed up a drow javelin and you're going through your stuff and you're like, oh, yeah. And Gent's like, ah, oh, right? In the middle of the chatter, I'm distracted by it. Pew, pew. And I say, I kind of think your command phrase shouldn't even be correct. Like, instead of swift death to my enemies, it should be something like pew pew or you're all fucked now. I kind of like pew pew because it's just a noncommittal onomatopoeia in response to the elven whispering. And Jet's like, me too. So this is like, it's funny.
But now it's let's get javelin.
Well, no, it's the thing is that Connor is going to get to javelin with his javelin. But this is also an important note here is that this is the moment when I was like, hey, Gent, you've got this in your inventory. We just sort of like put it there and then we didn't really mention it after. But this is kind of like a thing for you. And so now from this point, Gent begins using her badass oath bow, which has just been sitting in her inventory for a while. Getting back to it, Khan looks over the edge of the waterfall and points out down the length of the river. You'll want to follow this river. Eventually, you'll reach a deep gorge. Search around it, nearby, past it. You should eventually find an abandoned cottage nestled in the forest there. Sorry I can't give an exact location, but it wouldn't be of any value if it was easy to find. We in the Resistance use it as a safe house from time to time. Khan frowns. He hesitates before saying, anyway, you may be able to find more allies there. I get everyone to roll insight, and with an unnatural 20, and 11, and an 18, I say, Khan is clearly leaving some detail out, apparently because he's unsure of how it will go over with you. And Hex quickly scans their faces and says, right, anything we should know? And, God. Gent says, do I look like a whore because I don't like being fucked? And then Chantel says, oh my God, sorry. That was too edgy. I don't like the sound of that. I don't know Gent to have that personality. But she's feeling edgy because she got that cool bow, is what happened. That's what I bet happened. Khan sighs. The resistance, such as it is, our methods vary. Some of us are Nightside Eclipse turncoats. Others are, well, not all drow in these parts are loyal to the Nightside Eclipse, despite what House Aishir may claim. Some have adopted alternative faiths and notions regarding mortality in response to that status quo. You must understand that this, too, is a form of resistance. These acolytes may appear similar to Nightside Eclipse cultists in some ways, but they are not to be mistaken for enemies, I assure you. And Gent says, what do you mean, alternative faiths? And Hex says, Connor says, we've made some questionable friends in the past. Connor briefly looks very far away as he thinks of Gut Bones. And Khan Aishir says, I cannot claim to be an expert, but I believe they are aligned with some god of death or another. They seem to have some control over undead, though nothing like the scale of the Nightside Eclipse. And Jet says, so no tentacle rods? And Khan has to think on this carefully. Not that I know of. Well, great, necromancers. Not sure how MPOC's going to feel about that, but the Draelic army wants allies, so that's what we'll get, I guess. And I say, just to make sure, Khan volunteered Rhea as a guide for the army to show them secret entrances to Ashgrain Outpost. I assume you send her to rendezvous with the army rather than having her accompany you? They're like, yep. And I say, all right, ready to follow the river as Khan Aishir instructed, or do you have other plans? And they decide to follow the river. The river is roughly 20 feet wide and looks to be about 6 feet deep at its deepest. The rushing currents could easily pull a medium-sized creature under and drown them. You keep your distance using the river as a guide rather than a subject of investigation. After literal more than an hour, they spot a gorge. It is not hard to find. Within eyeshot of their position by the river, they see what seems to be a deep cleft in the forest. Approaching and examining it more closely, they suspect that the gorge must be nearly 100 feet deep, if not more. The surrounding rocks are grown over with vines and shrubs, and the trees of forest cluster around the steep edges with thick roots reaching down into the chasm. Rolling investigate with advantage, they search the brush surrounding the gorge as Khan instructed, and Hex stumbles across a small supply stash marked with drow writing. Inside, they find a map of Agaloc with 3 small pouches, each containing 25 gold. So everybody gets 25 gold. Gent's new total comes to 19,154 gold. From what they can tell, they are not far from Ashgrain Outpost now. It won't take more than a couple of hours to reach the rendezvous point, but it will require them to skirt the edges of the settlement. Based on what they've seen on herd, there's a good chance they'll run into slaver patrols in the process. And I ask, have you guys taken the time to examine Ashgrain Outpost itself on the maps? And Hex has familiarized himself. And I say, so you're noticing this trend in maps of Agaloc that include Ashgrain Outpost. Ashgrain Outpost on the maps, it's like that section of the map becomes like topographical. From what you understand, this is not to indicate that the settlement is on a hill or a mountain, but rather that it's like some kind of massive strip mine or quarry, like a huge wound in the forest terrain. You've begun to infer this more from descriptions of the people you met thus far that refer to it as a massive pit. Also, it apparently features underdark access points. Evidently, that wound in the forest landscape has begun to fester. And Gent says, looks like we're going to need dark vision. And I say, luckily, night vision is included in your trioptics. And Gent says, yeah, but I like to think that I said that and then slipped on sunglasses and went, yeah! And Hex simply says, my vision is augmented, which is a line from Deus Ex. And then I got entranced by a pretty grim gallery of out-of-control mining projects that I found on Google. And so I included this little picture. You know, I looked up terrible mining projects that gone out of control, and it's like none of them are like great to look at, but they're kind of like impressive in their horror.
Yeah.
This one's just like in the middle of a big old forest. It's like, dang, what an eyesore.
Beautiful forest, and just cut a giant chunk out of it.
Yeah. I just scooped a whole bunch of land out of that forest. So they continue to search for the abandoned cottage that Khan described. Eventually, they find themselves treading on soft dirt. And I have them roll investigate with advantage and arcana. Connor realizes that they are walking over dirt littered with bones and similar ravines. It seems a great many creatures were hastily buried in shallow graves around this area. He sees the bones of drow, dwergers, humans, also dog-like remains, likely hellhounds based on the reports of the drow. And there are what looks to be crushed and destroyed suits of dwarf-sized armor. Azer shells, he suspects. And Connor says, must be the fight Cog was talking about. And as they examine the evidence of the carnage underfoot, five drow slowly approach out of the surrounding darkness. One is a female drow that looks to have seen better days. She has pallid skin that does not look living, but her eyes shine with the brightness of intelligence, and she wears priest's robes. She prominently carries a symbol of a skull surrounded by a swirl of blood droplets. Another female drow accompanies the pale one, also bearing the same symbol. The other drow seem to be warriors of one sort or another. I have them roll religion, the whole group, but the symbol is unfamiliar to them all. The younger, more healthy-looking drow speaks. You stand before the death priestess Jada. Who are you, and why are you here?
Oh, these people seem nice.
And Gent inquires, how many droplets are on the swirl? And I say 12. So no six, unless it's a double six. You know, it's ever since this whole thing with six fingers and Gratz came up, everybody's checking for the number six just in case it pops up anywhere. And Hex says, we are forward scouts of the Draelic army. We're here seeking allies to assault Ashgrain Outpost. Khan Ishir sent us here. He said we might find some. The Death Priestess is silent, motionless, but her eyes gradually widen when Hex states their case. And rolling insight, the Death Priestess is unreadable. She turns her head slowly and looks to her aide. The younger drow looks to the priestess, then turns her attention back to the group. What is your plan? What would you ask of us? And Gent says, side note, we may want to be selective about how much we disclose here. And Hex says, to fight, that's all. We can offer you weapons and supplies if you would rendezvous with our main forces. Jada looks around at the other drow. There is an uncomfortable silence that goes on for too long. Gent says, maybe we were mistaken. The Death Priestess nods slowly. You do little to persuade us, strangers, and we cannot afford to trust easily. Nor can we afford to make ourselves vulnerable. The Death Priestess gives a ghoulish, unnatural smile. We wish you luck. Enjoy cowering in the shadows. Maybe after we're done, we can come back and finish off the Ishir, Hex spits. Oh!
Oh, boy.
Yeah, right? The Death Priestess begins to take her leave, striding back into the shadows of the forest, her guards close at hand. However, when Hex offers his insult, she turns around, eyes full of hatred. Four skeletons rise from the dirt, and the drow warriors draw wakizashi, and we roll initiative.
Boy, I mean, when you're a Death Priestess, though, it's like when you got a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
I don't know.
When you're a Death Priestess, every solution is death.
I mean, when you're a lizard man going to gather allies, if someone turns down your offer, you maybe don't offer to then come back and murder their entire family.
I agree. that was definitely a misstep.
It was a bold move, I'll say. I don't know if it was a misstep because it felt very intentional. So we enter combat. Jet says, yikes. And I say the drow warriors rush into the gap between the two pairs of skeletons and suddenly cast darkness, obscuring the area ahead of the group with magical darkness. Connor is unaffected. The enemies in the darkness are too far away for Jet to inherently sense them. And Hex steps into the darkness and uses his action to turn into a bat using his cloak of the bat. He then flies right over the skeletons and drow. And I say, cue bat out of hell. And he says, that it's me on my turn, though. The Death Priestess raps, Oshin! And the acolyte ahead of her fades into a shadow of herself. Connor recognizes this spell as Sanctuary. She then rapidly sprints in the darkness, coming at Gent from the side as the area in front of them is obscured. Gent says, bitch. And the skeletons come shambling out of the darkness to attack Connor and Gent, wielding wakizashis of their own. The first one clumsily falls and stumbles forward, failing to even swing at Gent. The next one hits Gent. Gent takes 12 slashing damage as the skeleton slashes at her side. Connor takes 8 slashing damage. The 4 skeleton's attacks are easily deflected by Connor's heavy armor. Connor casts Channel Divinity, Destroy Undead.
I mean, that'll do it.
Yeah, the Death Priestess passes. One of the skeletons saved, but the others are just destroyed. And then, Connor just goes up and, like, with his spirit weapon shovel and, uses his spirit weapon shovel to just, like, bludgeon the remaining skeleton into oblivion. Then, Janet draws her sunblade, smacks the priestess, hits with only a 15. All she has is a chain shirt. She hisses as Gent slices into her, but as it doesn't quite cleave through her the way she would like, it seems she's quite resilient, whatever she is. Gent disengages and moves north. The drow acolyte shouts, Vano! Connor recognizes this as some foul blessing of her death god. She then rushes to her mistress's side. Hex, gets a... Oh, right, sorry, I forgot. I forgot that Hex turned into a bat. So, Hex almost has...
Oh, you did mention that.
What's that?
You mentioned that.
Yeah, no, I mentioned it, but I'd forgotten it, because then I was reading something about Hex floating above them, and I'm like, how the heck's he doing that? But I know how he did that. It's because he's 15 feet off the ground as a bat. So, Gent uses her new ability to pew-pew mark the Death Priestess Jada. The shadowy arrow that darts out pins the priestess in her right leg, causing her to scream in agony. She obviously isn't used to this kind of damage. Connor shrugs off a few projectiles, which plink off his armor harmlessly after flying at him out of the darkness. He can tell the drow warriors are firing blowguns at him, and the darkness is on the blow darts. After failing to injure him, the drow rush behind Connor, and everyone but Gent and Hex are swallowed up in the magical darkness that's emanating from their blowguns. Funny thing is, Connor has the glowing eyes of Paylor's illumination, while they don't have the ability to see in magical darkness. So this is a you're locked in here with me sort of situation. Hex flies over into the darkness and drops out of bat form. Blind in the dark, he enters a rage and strikes out recklessly at where he sensed the priest in his bat form. He blasts at point blank with his Apollo laser pistol in melee. And as he lays into the Death Priestess in the darkness, he says, "So you're brave enough to die the second time around? One more necromancer to kill, then." And it's the Death Priestess's turn when we pick up, but that is where I broke. I had to figure out what the Death Priestess's spirit weapon looked like. Said, honestly, I really wasn't sure how the encounter with the Death Priestess was going to go. I'm really glad Hex pushed it in the end. More fun this way. Hex says he may have given up his oath of vengeance, but that doesn't mean he's super undead friendly. And I said, totally understandable. And Helfsize Shear would have been a known enemy back to him when he lived in his village. And, that is where we broke. Midway through the fight.
And did you break just because you weren't fully prepared for the fight?
It might have also just been the amount of time that was passing.
Yeah, it was almost
10 when, like, I usually, with that, when I was running this, we would break around, I would prefer not to go past 10. And so we broke at, like, 9:58. I knew that the fight was going to take longer, and that's a big thing, like, especially if it's an in-person session, I've said to DMs that I played with before is like, look, if it's like within a half hour of time to break and we have a combat ahead and you don't know if that combat is going to end in a half hour, break before the combat, please.
Yeah, I was going to say when it comes to when I break sessions, because I try my damnedest to like cover the full adventure in one session. I try to tailor each session so that it's like an episodic story that I can play through in about 3 hours. that has a logical conclusion point, even if the story is going to go on. But if something happens where like a combat takes much longer than I anticipated, and I know I'm going to have to break up the adventure over several sessions, I really do try to find those logical points where it's like, you know, even if I have to break in the middle of combat, I break when the gate explodes open and a giant, you know, cyclops comes through and it's like the next phase of the battle is about to begin and that's where we're going to break.
I did.
But it's rare that I break right in the middle.
Yeah, it's true. Don't often do this, but this is where I held it. I mean, it's easier when it is text-based and Roll20 and everything, and yeah, we can just leave everything in position.
Yeah, much easier to pick up where you left off again. Well, cool. I mean, I'm excited to see what the next phase of this is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, they've got to fight these Aishir cultists, so that's one detour on the way to Ashgrain Outpost.
And for me, the sort of the big moment of this one is the obvious one, where it's like, oh, calling out that Death Priestess right away. Okay, here we go. Throw down.
Hell yeah. Like I say, I was down with it. I didn't want it to be a kind of like inconsequential meeting where they just ask for help and then it's like, no, whatever. I was kind of glad that Alex pushed it. Meanwhile,
so we heading over to the danger room.
Yeah, I think so.
Not me. But back to the gates. And Tom, since our last recording, have you had any further thoughts on the gates?
Not entirely. I talked to Lucayo, who created it. I was mainly I was asking them if they wanted to come on the podcast, and they just recently did a retreat where they were doing a special game thing that they're a new project of theirs, basically. That was over the weekend, and so I don't know. Like, I think they might be a little drained from that, a little still recovering from that, so. Didn't get them right back this week, but I figure we've got any amount of time before these episodes come out to, you know.
Yeah, true enough. And I mean, they don't even have to come on like right hot on the heels of us covering the gates necessarily. But the thing that sticks with me when I, you know, was reviewing the rules, I guess, source document, I guess what you could call it, the source website, was still that puzzling question. It's the question that has come up before in the Danger Room, where it's like, how do you categorize different types of role-playing games? You know, what is an RPG by our estimation? We mainly talked about it when we were talking about things like Prawn, which was definitely, it was like a pool game with elements of LARPing, but is it an RPG or is it just like a party game? And with the gates, the question really seems to be like, okay, is it a game or is this a form of meditation, like a group meditation exercise that involves fantasy role play? Or is this honestly like part of some kind of ritual where you've got all of the participants sitting quite literally within a circle drawn on the floor, making offerings of things like liquor or herbs, very specific guidelines on like the space that you play it in and the rules of like when you're within the circle, you are within the world of the game that everyone is participating in. When you step outside, you return to the real world. And yeah, more than most, if not all, of the RPGs we've covered in the RPG Danger Room. This is the one where I'm going like, is this an RPG or is this something else? Is this a game or is this something else? Does this fall into a category that we had hitherto not considered? But I don't have any answers to that necessarily. It sounds like getting the author on here might lead to more answers in that regard. But do you have any thoughts on all that?
I mean, I don't know. The thing is that you talk about, like, is this a meditation that has fantasy role-playing elements? That's like, well, it's got fantasy role-playing elements, so that's something.
But, yeah, but you don't, you know, things like, we haven't gone through all the rules yet, so maybe in going through these rules, I've just missed the part where this is included, but it feels more like it doesn't feel like it has a conventional character sheet necessarily the way other RPGs might. It seems like the progression of the character is kind of different than how it would be in a more traditional RPG. Just sort of touching upon key markers that you and I have talked about before, the indicators that something is a, you know, capital R role playing, capital G game, RPG, like you'd find at a game store. And I feel like this one it doesn't necessarily fit all those criteria, but it doesn't necessarily disqualify itself either, if that makes sense. I don't know. It's an odd beast. Different stuff.
It definitely reminds me a lot of Nobilis and its structure, particularly when we talk about like character creation. Like when you talk about like the idea of a character sheet and stuff, it's like, well, I think my sheet in the Gates would look an awful lot like the sheet that I created for Nobilis, because it is very much like the power. Like it says here, reflection questions on discovering your power sources. In times of psycho-spiritual crisis, what/who have you turned to for help? What in your life has given you a sense of pride and power? What in your life has helped you become a better person? And what in your life has given you a sense of belonging and connection? Like, those are questions that you can fill out the answer to as if you were filling out the spaces in a character sheet. But sure, they are much more like Nobilis in terms of like how they are asked and presented.
But even Nobilis presented us with like sort of templated sheet figures that we fill in, right? Sometimes, but it feels like the Gates doesn't quite do that. But then, you know, I mean, I find myself just falling into that annoying habit of film students, of which I am a former film student, when you're talking about genre, where eventually it just becomes like, the fact is that genre is so arbitrary. And so I go like, is this an RPG? I mean, yeah, ultimately this is an RPG. It may have these differences. It may not tick all the boxes of what an RPG is or isn't that we've discussed in the past. But ultimately, like, this is a group of people with a game master involved guiding them through a story in which they all play characters. That's role-playing, right? That's a role-playing game in a literal sense.
It's an interesting question to start with, is like, ask Lucio, like, is it a role-playing game? First question, is this a role-playing game?
Yeah. we are definitely going to have to get Lukai on here and ask them some hard-hitting questions. Like,
I'm playing a game with them today, so.
Oh, perfect. Well, there we go.
Yeah.
Is this a role-playing game? Maybe that can be the table setting to them eventually being on the podcast. You can ask them that and get an answer tonight. And then we can go from there.
I think I'd rather... I don't want to ask them questions and then speak for them on the show. I'd rather just have them right on the show.
I mean, fair enough. But let's keep going with the rules. And I should say that, like, I'm really going through the rules piece by piece here because this is a sort of a Nobilis-like game, And it has a lot of differences from what we usually cover. I don't feel like I can skim necessarily. I feel like I gotta give this one some proper attention, since it's not something like a Forged in the Dark game or something like that, where we're already totally familiar with what it's built on. And so rather than just sort of give the broad strokes, I do want to give some specificity and we can talk about these ideas. So last time we talked about just like the whole setup of the game, you know, I mentioned before, like the things that you need in the space, the number of players, and then like a lot of terminology and just getting the game off the ground from the players brainstorming ideas for what they call the center, that I compared very similar to chancels and Nobilis. You know, it's like their home base for their characters. And then also we talked about the souls, which are the characters where they have, you know, these sort of three facets to each of them, an upper soul, a mid soul, and an under soul, and what each of those things meant. I've already drawn comparisons to things like The Matrix and also Cloud Atlas, especially with the idea of which soul was it? Is it the upper soul the one that draws upon your
ancestry?
Yeah, all of your the collective knowledge of all of your ancestors. Very Cloud Atlas idea there. So we've got like our group, we've got our characters, we've got our setup. And now we got to talk a bit about the conflict, which is the Ophrimus. I'm still uncertain on the pronunciation. Because it has Primus in there, I'm tempted to say Oprimus or the Ophrimus.
Oh, go sail the seas of cheese, you goof.
So after character creation is done, there is explicitly in the rules a short break, after which each participant, including the guide, must note which of the Ophrimus haunts them the most. So what is the Ophrimus? The general term for a class of terrible and dominating spirits that have spread across worlds upon worlds, consumed by fear and consuming through fear. They've been called archdemons and elder gods, but regardless of their legion of names, they are the reason you feel hunted and the reason you struggle beyond the bounds of life's hardships and turmoils. They can manifest to each quester in their own specific way. Some Ophrimus even war with each other while spreading their hatred or terror among the worlds. Yet they always act upon reality in the same fashion through curses, vendettas, and tyranny. During the initiation, which is that setup phase, you and the other questers can use a variety of methods in teasing out what kinds of Ophrimus haunt you each individually and as a group. Depending on the level of detail and trauma that each quester has, if you are going into deeply traumatic content, please ensure that your guide has holistic trauma-informed support training. So here we go. We're once again coming up against something where I go like, you know, is this a role-playing game? That sounds a lot like trauma therapy, suggesting...
If you're trained for it.
If you're trained for it. Mind you, this does also sound like stuff that you've told me about with World of Darkness, right?
Don't make your players actively uncomfortable.
Correct. But see, I'm still kind of amateurish when it comes to my knowledge of World of Darkness, but I know that in the past you've talked about, like, doesn't World of Darkness actively encourage you to not stray from like dark material and things like that?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot. So there were a lot of products released, but like in the new World of Darkness era, there's a lot of focus on like personal horror, and certain products had different takes on how you should be using and eliciting personal horror. Whereas some of them went a little too far without any kind of restraint. Basically, some of them were like, oh, like such and such should feel like a violation and you should make that clear to your players. And it's like, I don't like the sound of that. Things like, you know, getting turned into a vampire or things like that. Or the idea of using things that make players uncomfortable against them. I just don't agree with most of that. And like, yeah, I think if you're gonna get into some deeply traumatic content, as it says, makes sense to have your person running it have some like support training.
I guess it's also like the thing that gives me pause in reading that is, I guess this is something that you should really discuss with your guide well in advance of even getting to the initiation phase. At least that's what I'd insist upon if I was in this game. Because, I don't know, man. Like, it sounds like the deciding of the Opramus invites players to be very open about the things that scare them or that they struggle with mentally. And I just see the potential for that being really awkward for other players, you know? Like, this to me really feels like you should decide on the tone before you even sit down in the circle.
That's interesting to me, because for me, the conversation, like that awkwardness, that conversation is like an important part of the game, I think. I think that
it is an important part of the game. I guess this is also me once again grappling with sort of the dividing line between what is the reality and what is the game. Last episode we talked about how when, like in the section on creating the soul, your character's soul, there was one part of that section that just says that like the midsoul is you. It's like, it's you, Tom, you, the player, the person who is actually playing this game. You are the midsoul. And it's like, okay, well, if it's me, then when we get to the part where we're talking about the Opramus and it says something like, have each quester share their deepest fears, oppressive memories, and daily mental health struggles. Like, is that talking about me? Do I, McGill, like, am I being asked to say, like, you know, I struggle with depression daily?
I mean,
or do I make something up? Am I supposed to make something up? I think my deepest fear.
I think the important thing. I think that you don't make something up. I think that you pick something real, but it is a conversation that you guys figure out what the real thing is that you want to be fighting against, right? Like,
right. I guess my concern is that when it is something rooted in reality, this is what I was getting at about, like, I would worry about not setting the tone in advance and making it clear what to expect for the other players. Because if we're in this Opramus phase and one of the players says, like, you know, I was assaulted when I was a teenager, that's hard to untangle in a group setting impromptu without any forewarning.
True.
So, yeah.
True. Definitely. I mean, again, we're leading into that whole thing of, like, at that point, the guide has to have the trauma-informed support training, yeah. Right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
So I can see what you're saying about, like, but I don't know. I guess for me, part of the conversation is, do we go that far, right? Like,
right, right.
I don't know.
It's funny because I say, like, this should be discussed in advance, but I guess that's what the point of this phase is to decide on those
That's
boundaries.
What I'm trying to say is that I think that as much as, like, it makes sense to handle some of these topics up front, I think that, like, the point where you do decide what is too heavy of a thing for you guys to be dealing with in your present game, that is something that you guys come together, like, mm-hmm. conversationally through this phase, the initiation.
Then I guess my real thought here is, like, this is for seasoned role players.
Potentially.
I do not. Potentially.
Seasoned people who have spent a lot of time in group therapy. I don't know.
Well, yes. I would absolutely think. I'd almost think that is the better background for something like this, if indeed the purpose is to genuinely explore all of the different players' oppressive memories or deepest fears.
I think that's interesting. There is, like, a question here is, like, do you want your role-playing game to deal with real shit, McGill? Do you want to sometimes, like, I think that, you know, this is part of actually, I think, like, where some of that misguided idea in New World of Darkness came from, where it was like, people, it was this edgy thing of like, oh, I don't want to play just some wishy-washy fantasy game. I want a real-ass game that deals with real-ass dark personal horror.
Gritty is the word.
I want to really get into the psyche of the player and stuff. And it's like, the thing is, when I was in high school, I totally like fell for that rhetoric of like, your game could be doing more than it is. Your game could be a bigger deal, could be, do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
This idea that, like, it's not just a game, man. It gets into, like, serious shit, man. And, like, I don't know. Is there any impulse to which you actually feel that way about your role-playing games, where, like, you kind of wish that you had role-playing games that took you to, like, another level where you, like, did, like, interface with sort of your psychology or things like that? Or is like that something that's just not interesting to you?
That's a tricky one to answer, because I definitely feel like there has been a time in my life where I wasn't afraid to sort of push the envelope a bit and make my players go like, whoa, that got dark. But the goal for me,
more than just dark, is the idea of like, that felt really real. Is like, that didn't feel like just a game. That felt like I can take away things from that about my life.
Yeah, I'm kind of disinclined on that one personally.
It reminds me of, because I did improv, and it reminds me of, there is like an impulse you sometimes get where, like, you know, the vast majority of improv is like funny. It's for the laugh. Yeah. You do it comedically. But then, like, I don't know, you do it for long enough, particularly if you're into role-playing games and stuff. And like, there's definitely been the time that I've been like, would it be cool to do like something that was like more dramatically improvised? And of course, that's just like my desire to role-play right there. Mm-hmm. But it is a similar thing of like, yeah, it's not just that the game is that you took it to a dark place, but that you took it to a place that was like, yeah,
real.
Yeah, real.
Yeah, I really don't tend to do that with my RPGs, but I don't know. That's not to say that I think anybody should or shouldn't necessarily. I guess it's more that when I run RPGs, the emphasis for me is on the game part of that, where it's a role-playing game. We're doing this to have some fun. And so I tend to, you know, I have emotional moments, certainly, but it's never necessarily going to be something that the players are going to like come away from the game going like, oh man, I'm still thinking about, you know, that time the NPC died. That really affected me on a deep and personal level. Escapist, definitely escapist. But something I will say is that I do incorporate real ideas into my games. It's just never like a one-to-one thing. When I started the Forgotten Realms campaign that I've been referencing several times on this episode, I started it back in, I want to say like 2020. I think it was like summer of 2020, right at the start of the pandemic, because all the players, of course, were stuck at home. None of us were going out or had anything to do, so we all started playing D&D together. And at the time, I was really having these feelings, these hopeless feelings, like there are forces in the world that are so much greater than me. How can someone like me make a difference? And I knew that, especially in 2020, a lot of my players were struggling with similar feelings. So my goal with the campaign that I was designing was to start with them feeling that, like there's a big evil force, there's a big malevolent force in the world, and how can you, just a handful of people, even make a difference against something so big? But I always wanted the payoff to be like the power fantasy that I was having, which is like, man, if I ran the world, maybe I could do it differently. Maybe there was something I could do differently that would give us hope in these dark times if I were, you know, a hero of legend. So I guess that's sort of how I reflect real things in the games, is I take sort of the ambient feelings that I am feeling with vague inspiration from things in the news and channel that into my game. But it's not really something that the players would necessarily recognize. You know, like if I have, for example, a horde of bloodthirsty orcs, like the ones that turned up in the campaign, and they're launching an attack against the seat of government of a major, you know, place like Waterdeep. Players don't necessarily recognize the real world reference there, but if you think about it, I'm sure you could put together exactly what I was playing, the idea and what was on my mind and in the news at the time that I wrote that.
Was it the 6th of January?
Exactly that. Exactly. But so that's what I mean, is I don't often deal with things that feel very real, but I do take my inspiration from very real emotions, thoughts, and goings on. But this is all just very interesting to me. And again, you know, this Opramus stuff, like is this group therapy, or is this World of Darkness, or is this somewhere in between?
I mean,
let's talk about, oh, sorry,
it's
go ahead.
An interesting idea is, like, is there a looming concern or worry in your life that you wish that you could be a weird sort of extra-dimensional adventurer and go fight as a big monster?
Yeah. And, you know, thinking on that... I brought up the Matrix before, but all of this really feels like the concept of the Matrix to me, where it's like the big thing that, a struggle beyond the bounds of life's hardships and turmoils. It's like in the Matrix where they go like, you know, do you ever feel like you're not even in control of your own life? These malevolent forces controlling everything around you or working against you from the shadows. Well, you know, here we go. That's what we're dealing with here. Similar to the Matrix itself. Or you ever heard of a movie called Ink? You ever heard of this movie called Ink?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, man, it's a really weird low budget movie that, frankly, I'd love to get your thoughts on, Tom, because it's sort of like this overstuffed sci-fi fantasy epic, but clearly done like with camcorders and on an extremely low budget, about a dimension hopping troll bounty hunter who's got magic drums that let him open portals to other dimensions. And then there are these creatures who are very much like the agents in the Matrix, and they're after, you know, this kid. It's a wild ride, but I'm getting reminded of Ink as we go through the gates as well. Here are the different ways that you can decide on your Opramus. The talking method, similar to how the power sources were discovered, each quester shares their deepest fears, oppressive memories, and daily mental health struggles. The dream method involves questers sharing their nightmares and dreams, looking to each other and the guide to interpret the messages that are being sent to them from their ancestors or the guardians of the spirit lands about the Opramus. This is interesting. I find that one really interesting, but it kind of sucks because I never remember my dreams. I don't know what it is. For some reason, it's very rare that I actually remember what I dreamt.
Man, I have hyper-vivid dreams. Ever since I got on medications back in high school, I've had like the wildest dreams. And
wow.
Yeah, I have recurring dreams. I had the dream that I have all the time that I have to bring to the Opramus, you know, figure it out, bring to the gates, is I'm always getting stuck in transit. I'm in one place and I have to leave it to get to another place, and then it doesn't matter how I get there. It's a bus, a train, a plane, what have you. The bus breaks down, the plane has a transfer that doesn't go through, and I get stranded at an airport, the train goes to the middle of nowhere, and I end up stuck there. It's always, I end up stuck between two places.
That's very interesting. Dream Tom is trapped in the liminal.
Yeah, because nobody's given Tom a house.
My wife has very similar dreams, or at least she did for a long time when her anxiety was a lot worse. Dreams specifically of being trapped on buses in Paris that never stopped. She's like on a public bus in Paris, and the bus just never stopped at any stops.
Mine always, like, there's always another bus that I have to catch from another, like, I always have to get off one bus and then, like, transfer to another one, and then I, like, lose the bus in the transfer or something.
For a while there, I was having these dreams, these recurring dreams, where I was walking through empty museums. And it was rare that it was the same museum twice. I always knew they were museums, but they were completely empty. It's weird.
We've officially become the most boring podcast on the internet, but...
Just talking about our dreams.
One time, I had a friend told me about a dream that reminds your. I told this story recently, but your museum dream reminds me of it too. Is I had a friend, and she had a dream that basically she's going through a maze of doors, and every door is marked, is like labeled with like something she is afraid of. So like there's a door that's marked
this sounds perfect for the gates.
There's a door that's marked monsters, there's a door that's marked dinosaurs, there's a door that's marked disease, there's a door that's marked whatever. And then she's wandering through this maze, and then at some point she realized that she's like come full circle and she's back where she was in the maze, except now all the doors are open.
Oh no.
How fucking crazy is that? Like that.
That's wild.
That's such a fucking spooky dream.
Yeah, that's really something. Boy, and is that where the dream ends?
That's like all they like.
Whoa.
Yeah, and they told me that story years ago, years and years ago. That was like in first year film. Someone told me that story.
Oh my God.
It was how she described how she felt watching Inland Empire by David Lynch.
And, oh, interesting.
I was like,
I get that.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And my immediate thought, because we're on an RPG podcast, is like, well, there's an adventure.
Yeah.
You know, so pick your big evil bad guy. You know, maybe it's an Illithid and it's
ooh,
a
that'd
psychic
be a good
maze.
Game of Dread.
Ooh, it would be a good game
you
of Dread.
You wake up in the laboratory of fears. And then all the doors are open and you're like, but where are all the fears?
Yeah, exactly. Man, that would be good. And then the third method for choosing an opremus is the book method. The book method is about using descriptions of oppression in political or spiritually political books as a way to decipher which opremus is plaguing you and your group. So this is actually not dissimilar from what I was talking about, where I draw real world inspiration for my campaigns. From, you know, current political oppression and things of that nature. A useful book for this would be Starhawk's Truth or Dare, which has 9 categories and extensive descriptions for each. The conqueror, the master, the orderer, the judge, the censor, the compliant, the withdrawn, the rebel, and the manipulator. I am unfamiliar with this book. Have you ever heard of this?
No. Nope.
Starhawk's Truth or Dare.
Made by someone named Starhawk.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into that more.
Yeah, I was thinking about, because we got the dream method, and I know what dreams I would bring up, but you know, the dream method for me is probably pretty deeply connected to the talking method for me as well, because I think in the talking method, I have, like, without getting into it too deep, I have like a bad memory of like a time when I was living with my ex and I had a bad roommate. And I feel like a lot of those, I feel like those dreams I have about getting stuck in transit are very much about, or are rooted in this sense of not having a place of my own. And this idea of like being made to leave the place that you thought was yours. You know what I mean?
Right.
But basically I've got my ideas for like what I would use, what I would bring up in the talking method or what dreams I would bring up in the dream method. But then for the book method, I would probably grab my good old, The Conspiracy Against the Human Race by Thomas Ligotti.
Not familiar with it myself.
It's a book that a lot of people claim that True Detective Season 1 did a lot of plagiarizing of. It's like a book written by Russ Cole about how miserable life is. Which also, like, yeah, I wonder if that's inappropriate or not, you know? It's like, am I allowed to bring my, like, my existentially pessimistic book to be like, yeah, my problem is being alive.
I really, like, again, I say, I feel like it's really important to just have a sense of, like, everyone who's going to be playing and the tone that's going to be struck in advance of all of these things. Because, like you said, Tom, like, you know, what if you're sitting down at this game, you know, you're friends with one other person in the game, but you don't really know the other players, and then someone's like, my curse is being alive. What do you do with that?
Well, you gotta interface with it. You gotta be like, damn, why do you feel that way?
Yeah.
That's the whole fight right there. That's where you come together and you're like, well, damn, we got an Optimus to handle.
I like that. Maybe I'm just too much of a pessimist. Maybe I need to take a more optimistic, proactive point of view like that, where it's like, well, damn, this person is struggling.
My worry would continuously be that I am, like, too ignorant of the things that we are covering. Like, yeah, man, I don't even...
Definitely.
Like you say, you don't know Starhawk's truth or dare. I don't know Starhawk's truth or dare. Maybe they know something I don't.
Well, Tom, let's talk a bit about curses, and then maybe we can put the bookmark in there for this episode. So, once you've decided on the Optimus...
Oh yeah, this is where things start to get fun.
A curse. A curse is some kind of detrimental effect on one or both of your souls in the spirit lands that affects you and by association the people around you. For example, a questor may be cursed with having toads come out of their mouth whenever they are in their undersoul form. They cannot speak to other questors like this and are generally ill from the taste of toads. The group travels through the gates into the spirit lands where the Toad Queen resides. Upon their arrival, the Toad Queen explains that the cursed quester has not been acknowledging or building a relationship with the land, the spirit lands, and its people and the world they're from. And so the land could not protect them from a curse by an Optimus, either a capitalist Optimus or a withdrawn Optimus from Starhawk's Truth or Dare. We gotta look into this. The Toad Queen hints that the other questers are unaffected because of their connection to their ancestors. The group then travels to an underworld to support the cursed quester as they search for an ancestor that can assist them in building a relationship with the land. Once found, the cursed quester gains one ancestral source token. The group goes through the gates again to visit the land spirit, where each quester uses an ancestral source token to give an offering to the land, acknowledge the mistakes or responsibilities of their ancestors to the land, and make a commitment to mend or maintain relations. The land gives their blessing, the curse is lifted, and this battle is won. All questers increase the number of community power tokens they have by the number of questers in their group as well. They also get one land power source token each. A lot of talk of tokens that we will get into next time, because that's like the key actions and mechanics of the game are token-based. Types of actions and using source tokens is like a whole section.
Much like miraculous actions in Nobilis.
Yeah, very similar to miraculous actions in Nobilis. And you're right. This is sort of where the fun part comes in, where, you know, we've decided on the Optimus. Maybe the Optimus is all your worst fears are being released on the world in your dream maze or whatever. And then you can, that quester can...
Or in my case, one of my souls is always getting lost because it's always getting stuck in transit, right?
There we go. Yeah, I love that.
There's a consuming fog that's been following me around or something.
That's great. And then the guide and parts of the source book that we haven't covered yet will determine sort of the path to alleviating that curse by confronting an Aw-Primus.
But what's very funny about that, or what's very interesting to me about that, is that you and the guide can also decide, like, what we're going to find moving from curse to vendetta is you guys can basically, you know, you can try and sum it up as a curse, but you can then also be like, nah, that was too easy. Like, that doesn't really solve my problem. Because, you know, there's, well, sorry, what were you going to say, McGill?
I mean, you sort of hit upon it. I was just sort of summing up how this all comes together, where, like, the Aw-Primus is the overarching threat to that particular quester and therefore the group as a whole. And then the curse is, like, the specific symptom of that threat, or one of many specific symptoms of that threat. That it's sort of like the initial quest, right? You've got all these small quests that are doing things like alleviating curses, and they all add up to the larger quest, which of course is dealing with the Aw-Primus that has been decided upon as the group. And there are other I guess you could say levels of curses. Maybe that's the way to put it. There are vendettas and there are tyrannies, but you know, we're bumping up against our time limit. So I think I'll get into those more next time, leading into how to battle the Aw-Primus itself, which is sort of, it seems to be like the main thrust that dictates the directions the story goes in.
Yeah. Yeah, I personally, like, I there's something really enticing about the idea of, like, being able to sort of set your difficulty challenge for your Aw-Primus and being able to sort of see, like, okay, you've got this curse, how do we remedy this curse, but then say, but what's the bigger thing behind this curse? Like, what really allowed this curse to happen? And I find that that is, like, an interesting iterative sort of psychological process, really, is, like,
yeah,
you know, talking about the disease rather than the symptoms, that sort of thing. And the fact that that is part of the game that you play through, I think is really fascinating.
And it is actually sort of reflective of how I've constructed some of my own campaigns in the past, where I tend to, I rarely introduce the main antagonist right away, and often have the players encounter symptoms of that antagonist's machinations long before they actually encounter the antagonist themselves, you know? To use a Star Wars comparison, they end up fighting a bunch of Darth Mauls before they even figure out that there's the Emperor behind it all.
All right, well, are we gonna break there?
I think so. We're not in the middle of combat.
But we are in the middle of the gates.
Of the gates.
So, if you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Compare and Campaign on Facebook. And if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, check us out on compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. And if you want to check out the gates, check out the-gates.weebly.com, and that's where you'll find all the rules.
That's right, but do you level up? Do you get a ding? You
get a token anyway. There are levels to your powers.
There are, and there are tokens you acquire.
Level 5 is destruction.
So level up your power, get those tokens.
It's pretty cool. All right. Yeah, take care, everybody.